It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Toxic PFAS chemicals have been a growing concern in Wisconsin in recent years, showing up in drinking water and surface water.
The class of chemicals has been used in a wide variety of industrial and commercial processes, from firefighting foam to nonstick surfaces in consumer products.
A new WPR report finds another source of PFAS contamination, biosolids from industrial and wastewater treatment spread on farm fields.
Biosolids are seen as a cost-effective alternative to imported fertilizers, but their use over time has led to high levels of PFAS in some communities.
WPR reporter Danielle Kading is with us for a look at the story. Danny, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
You start your story, Danny, in the town of Stella, that's just east of Rhinelander. How are they being affected by PFAS there?
Yeah, the town of Stella and the community of Starks has seen some of the most significant impacts from PFAS contamination in the state. The DNR has said some of the highest levels of the chemicals in drinking water nationwide have been discovered in private wells there. And a site inspection conducted on behalf of the EPA last year found that PFAS there is significantly higher than typical background levels within field soil, groundwater, and surrounding lakes or surface water.
I've heard of a lot of different sources of PFAS. Danny, your reporting is the first I've heard of this this biosolid spreading being part of the story. What are the biosolids at the heart of this story in Stella and elsewhere?
Sure. So biosolids are basically the same as treated sewage sludge. So when waste is treated at wastewater plants, that process separates the liquids from the solids. And what's left over is this nutrient-rich material that's often used by farmers as an alternative to fertilizer, as Kate mentioned.
And that comes from wastewater treatment plants. And in some cases, it's from an industrial facility as well, right?
That's right. It can come from several sources, that being industrial sludge, municipal treatment plants, and septage.
What kind of things are those biosolids tested for? They're waste products. I assume we're watching for some kind of pollutants in them.
Yeah, I mean, biosolids and sludge have long been tested for pathogens or bacteria and things like heavy metals, but they're not widely tested for PFAS right now because the EPA doesn't currently require that testing of sludge for the chemicals, and there are no federal or state standards that currently exist for PFAS and sludge. And the EPA is still evaluating the health risks tied to spreading this material on land before making any decision about regulating PFAS and biosolids.
And these biosolids, this isn't just happening in Stella, Wisconsin. This is a very common thing that we put on fields, right?
Yes. I mean, we worked with the DNR after requesting some records, and the data that we received showed around 1.2 million acres are approved to receive biosolids, industrial sludge, and septage. And the DNR says that that waste is spread on roughly 500,000 acres statewide each year.
In an interview with our colleagues at PBS Wisconsin, the chairperson of Stella, William Casey Crump, expressed concern about the different ways PFAS spreads, including going on the fields, as we're talking about.
They spread this stuff on my fields for years and years and years. I lived on that field. I grow vegetables in my garden, which turned out really good this year. Now I have concerns about consuming those vegetables because we water with our well water. We planted them in the soil that our property sits on. In addition to that, I lease out my land, and so corn is grown on that land. I think that corn goes to feed cattle and livestock. Are the cattle and livestock now consuming that corn?
Danny, what kind of things did you hear from people in the Stella area about their concerns here about these biosolids and PFAS chemicals?
Well, honestly, Rob, I found people were very reluctant to talk about this issue. I called a lot of people who either had contaminated wells or were a party to a class action lawsuit against the owners of the paper mill, current and former. I called farmers and businesses and the past and present town chair, but most didn't want to talk about it or didn't respond to me. And, you know, some cited the ongoing litigation. Some didn't want to stir the pot or draw attention to themselves, and others said farmers fear being forced out of business. And the people I spoke with on the Moen Lake chain are pretty frustrated that they're dealing with the stigma of PFAS contamination, and they still wonder about the data and the actual risks. Many people there have been eating fish from those lakes for years.
From the people you were able to talk to, what did you hear about the potential risks? Again, there's still a lot we don't know here. What kind of things, as you talk to different people, do we know and don't we know about the risks associated with PFAS being spread again on fields here?
Well, when we're talking about like regulators, basically the EPA has said farm families who get most of their diet from food grown on lands contaminated by PFAS in sewage sludge, they face higher risk. And some of the highest risk came from drinking milk or eating eggs and beef from cows that graze on lands that had this contaminated biosolids. Or people also faced higher risks if they drank contaminated water and ate fish from lakes that were affected by runoff from lands that had received PFAS contaminated sewage sludge.
You talked to Jeff Siemering, a staff scientist with UW-Madison Division of Extension, to get a sense of more of what we know and what we don't know about how this spreads. Here's a listen.
Even from a single application, you're seeing some plant uptake. Would it be toxic to an animal at that level? That we don't know, because we're not running that kind of a study.
And right. So, Danny, we know, okay, runoff into water, that's a concern. A big question mark, it sounds like, is... And we've heard from both of those clips we've played, does this get into plants? Does this get into the food chain? Is there any talk from Jeff Siemering or others about a need for that kind of research?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a developing area of research. There hasn't been much attention to biosolids as much as there has been to drinking water contamination from these chemicals. But what he did share is that, you know, when we're looking at the roots and the plant tissue itself, longer chain PFAS like PFOA and PFOS are more likely to remain in the roots or the soil of plants. And the shorter chain chemicals that are often used as alternatives to PFAS can concentrate up in the plant tissue. So there's a lot still that we have to learn about the impacts or possible food chain impacts. But the EPA does say that some farmers may want to consider reducing their risk by avoiding spreading the sludge on fields where they grow feed or where dairy cows or other livestock graze. And so there's just a lot of the risk depends on site-specific factors as well and spreading frequency and rates.
We're talking to WPR reporter Danielle Kading. She is reporting on the use of biosolids on fields around Wisconsin. Very common practice for fertilizer. Concerns about the PFAS classes of chemicals showing up in those biosolids. Danny, you talked to Steve Warner, statewide site review coordinator for the wastewater program at the Wisconsin DNR, about the idea of testing for PFAS. Here's some of what he had to say.
Those sampling requirements can be put into a permit. So once this strategy was evolving, it just takes time to go through that 5-year renewal cycle for every permit in the state.
Right. So is there any movement, Danny, toward saying, yes, in addition to the other tests we're doing on these biosolids, we're going to start testing for at least some of the PFAS class of chemicals when we give these permits?
Yeah, I mean, the DNR began requiring this testing last year, and according to the data that we received, at least 130 municipal plants and industrial facilities, have tested so far. And there's varying results. I think we found that more than a third of those 130 facilities had levels of PFAS that were concerning enough that treatment plants should look at reducing or investigating the source of those chemicals, but it wouldn't stop them from spreading. There were about several plants that were identified as having significant levels of contamination where they would suggest alternative treatment or disposal and not approve any new land application sites.
Danny, bigger picture, you and we have been following the story of how the state is dealing with PFAS, some funding allocated. There was a long-running standoff between the governor and lawmakers about how to use that funding. One of the core questions is the idea of the innocent user of a product, right? If I'm a farmer, There's PFAS contamination on my land, maybe because of biosolids that I didn't know there was PFAS in. Am I liable? What is the status of that argument in the state, and, you know, how to hold people liable potentially for PFAS contamination without punishing people who inadvertently ended up with it in their on their property?
Well, there's been some movement on the legislation that was introduced by Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger and Representative Jeff Mersaw. They introduced a couple of bills earlier this year to create grant programs to address PFAS, and one that would exempt certain individuals or facilities from paying for PFAS contamination they didn't cause, so that innocent landowner provision. But there's a lot of debate over that still. The DNR says the current version of the bills would still allow polluters to get off the hook. So there's been requested revisions to the language. Republicans and Governor Tony Evers have been at odds over this approach. They just don't agree on a path forward right now of how to protect certain individuals and provide these resources to communities and people who are struggling with contamination.
As we wrap up, Danny, what are you watching for? What's the big open question or next step on your mind in our last half a minute?
Well, I'm just curious to see what testing will reveal over time. I mean, we know that the spreading is occurring on roughly 500,000 acres statewide, but it's really unclear what level of risk people are facing, because we just don't know how much PFAS might be in that sludge. So I think it will be important to track what the testing shows.
Danny, thanks as always for sharing your work with us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, reporter based at WPR's Superior Bureau. We've been talking about her reporting on PFAS contamination and biosolid fertilizers on farm fields. You can read a lot more of her work. Head over to WPR.org. Again, find that reporting at WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, the Sauk Prairie School District sees a big jump in the number of young kids who need speech and language support services. The superintendent questions all the screen time.
Many of us learned how to speak with face-to-face interaction with a parent or a caregiver or siblings, and that it's more difficult to learn those same skills through a screen.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Schools around the state are noticing an increase in the need for speech and language support services in early elementary grades as more and more of the youngest learners struggle with language development.
The Sauk Prairie School District in South Central Wisconsin saw an 87% increase over the past three school years in the number of referrals for speech and language services.
To learn more about this issue, we turn to Rebecca Alper, a bilingual English-Spanish speech-language pathologist who's an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders and director of the Weissman Center's Language Literacy and Learning Lab. Rebecca, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jeff Wright is here, superintendent of the Sauk Prairie School District. The district northwest of Madison serves about 2,800 students. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
Jeff, starting with you, can you tell us about the increased need for speech and language intervention in your district and what you're seeing?
Well, I think it's important to start with an acknowledgement that there's always been students who need speech language support. And so that's not new. What we've noticed over the past few years is an increase in the number of students who need that support. And we've been doing research to try to figure out what has caused an increase in the need of speech language support among 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds. And we continue to find research that's pointing to an increased use of screens in early years, maybe a contributing factor to the increased number of students who are needing the speech language support. Knowing that many of us learned how to speak with face-to-face interaction with a parent or a caregiver or siblings, and that it's more difficult to learn those same skills through a screen.
These are our youngest learners. They're coming in for 4K. They're coming in for kindergarten. What stands out to you? What are teachers saying?
Well, we certainly see changes in the students that are coming to us. And we serve students as young as 3 years old. If families or maybe a pediatrician identifies a need for speech-language support, we're seeing changes as society is – we're looking at childhood moving from play-based to screen-based for a lot of our children. And the American Academy of Pediatrics would suggest that before 2 years of age, really children should have almost no screen use that's not a shared experience with an adult. But more and more children are on screens increasing amount of the time during the day. And we're seeing changes not only in their speech patterns and their speech development, but also their patience, their ability to collaborate with others, to look people in the eye early on. And these are certainly things that we're seeing in 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds, but we also know adults who are experiencing the same problems and same issues. This is a collective problem in our society as we've moved from play-based to screen-based experiences. So our youngest children aren't exempt from those issues.
Rebecca, many of the caregivers who you work with have concerns about screens and speech delays. Why might these devices slow down speech and language development?
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing to keep in mind is that speech-language learning, and when we think about speech, we really think about the sounds and the motor component of communication. And when we think about language, we really think about the underlying meaning. So the words that children know, what they know about words, you know, dogs have four legs, things like that. And so early language learning in particular is a social interactive process. Children learn language through back and forth contingent responses with their environment. And that contingent part is really essential because what it means is that the caregivers in the environment or the peers are responding to the child based on their interest in a close temporal proximity, so soon after the child has said or done something, as well as in relationship to their topic of interest. So what we see is that particularly young children, under the age of 2 in particular, are really reliant on those social interactions for language learning.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Jeff, you know, districts are still catching up kids from the pandemic learning losses when so many children had to turn to screens. We know math and reading scores have suffered. Can any of the communication difficulties that you're seeing in students now be connected to the pandemic?
We certainly saw cultural changes in our relationship with screens as a result of the pandemic. But the children we're talking about weren't even born at the time of the pandemic. And so I think the pandemic is an easy excuse potentially to place, well, it's still the pandemic and that's why we're seeing these changes. But these children weren't born at that time. What we do know is that societally, our patterns changed during the pandemic, and adult screen use increased, teenage screen use increased. And so it's not a surprise that we're seeing screen use also increase among our youngest children. I think this is also a reality that has changed as more and more parents are working from home. And parenting is hard. Parenting, I think that people do the best they can with the incredibly difficult and challenging reality of being parents in a modern age. If you're working from home and you have a 1-year-old, a 3-year-old at home with you at the same time that you're trying to focus, giving that child a screen or a device to keep them busy for a while you're trying to complete a meeting, it's an understandable reaction of a family or a parent. And so I think that that's something that has changed post-pandemic is with this increased number of families that are working from home, that a device can become the default caregiver at times or the default game instead of some of the things that many of us would have done when we were children, when given free time, boring time, when we need to find something to do to keep our minds active even at 2 or 3 years of age.
There is that reflex, Rebecca, to hand over your phone when you're in that grocery line or when you need that child to be distracted because you're doing something else. Can you talk about that tension and what that can potentially yield?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that I so strongly agree with the idea that people are doing the best that they can, given really complex circumstances with lots of different conflicting needs pulling in a lot of different directions. Screen use is not all the same, and it's not an all or nothing situation. So my first question, or the first thing that I suggest that people reflect on, is what would be happening if the screen weren't present? So, like, if the caregiver is trying to get the groceries onto, you know, the conveyor belt, and, you know, they hand their child an iPad or a screen to keep them busy so that they can get checked out of the grocery store, get the bags to the car. It's very possible that in the absence of doing that, it's not necessarily that they're going to be having a high quality back and forth interaction with their child. So I encourage people to think about, again, you know, if it's, you know, food prep or, you know, the caregiver needs to go to the bathroom or whatever it is, there are times when it's not like the absence of a screen would mean that there would be high quality interaction. But then with a screen, we know that interactive screen watching and developmentally appropriate programming that offers opportunities to kind of stop and talk with the caregiver and the child, you know, that there are better options as well within screen usage. So, but yeah, the first thing that I always encourage people to think about is just try to think about the times where if you weren't using a screen, there might actually be interaction going on. And those are the easiest to think about first.
Jeff, can you talk to us about the role a school district has to provide speech and language supports to students? You know, if a student is in a speech and language therapy, how does the school intervene and how that progresses?
Well, it does look different for every child. But it, as I said earlier, it can begin as early as 3 years of age. It may be that a family identifies a concern with the development of speech patterns with their child. And so that family can reach out to the school and ask for their child to be evaluated. And if the student does have those needs, at the age of three, the school district can already start working with that family. The support looks different. For some students, we'll actually go to their homes and help with that child's development. For other students, at 3 years old, they start to come to an elementary school and develop a relationship with a speech-language pathologist that may last for several years. We still have students in high school that are receiving speech-language support, and that could have begun very early on in their educational journey, or it could have been something that was identified by a teacher partway through their schooling and realizing, you know, this student does need some additional individualized support to make sure that they're growing the way we want them to. In our case, we also make sure that some of that support is happening within the classroom. We don't want it to only be that students are pulled out of that instructional environment. There are a lot of times where we're able to have several students be engaged in speech-language support at the same time in a kindergarten or first grade classroom within the regular rhythm and the regular experience of that class.
We're talking about an increased need for speech and language services in some Wisconsin schools and how screen time may impact a child's development. Jeff Wright is superintendent of Sauk Prairie School District, and we have speech-language pathologist Rebecca Alper, who is an assistant professor of communication sciences and disorders at UW-Madison and leads the Waisman Center's Language Literacy and Learning Lab. Jeff, the reality is that Chromebooks are in the classroom, and so many tablets or lesson plans are really coming from that Chromebook. And as a district, how do you grapple with the idea that screens are a part of delivering the curriculum?
At our earliest grade levels, we are really deliberate about limiting screen use to when it is something that could only be done through a screen. We know that our youngest children are experiencing plenty of time on other devices through the rest of their day. And so when they are surrounded by like-aged peers, how can we make sure that every day involves purposeful play, that they're learning math and learning how to read, but at the same time learning those skills through play with like-aged peers? There's just learning how to share, learning how to make rules, learning how to resolve conflict when you've broken rules. Some of those things only happen through play. And then as kids get older, just like adults, conversation is our play. Like we sit around a dining room table or we go to a restaurant and we tell stories. That how do we make sure that we create as many spaces as possible where our young people can be engaging in device-free conversation, device-free play while they're in our schools? We also have really focused more attention on outdoor experiences, especially in our younger grade levels. We have one school where the first and second graders spend a full day outside every day of the school year, even in the winter.
Wow.
It's only thunder and lightning that brings us inside, with the idea that device-free learning, it has to be a priority of us during the school day, because we know that devices and the television and other things are a more dominant part of the time when students aren't with their like-age peers.
Meanwhile, though, you have to meet this influx of students who need services. Does your district have enough funding and staff to support the children in speech and language?
We did hire an additional person this year, and I appreciate our school board's commitment to meeting the unique learning needs of these young children. That was a decision that is primarily a cost borne by local school districts because the reimbursement rate in Wisconsin is not very high for special education. But it is a priority, and if it helps make sure that students have long-term success because we make that investment in their their first grade, their kindergarten, their three-year-old experience, hopefully that will result in stronger benefits for that child the rest of his or her educational career.
Rebecca, are you seeing challenges with the speech and language support and having the resources to meet these children one-on-one with their needs?
Yeah, so I think that again, this is a really interesting issue because overall, children are very resilient language learners. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. It's very unlikely that there is one unique causal thing like a screen that is leading to a child having a persistent language disorder. We do see that there is just in general, there has been more awareness around language delay and language disorder, and the difference really there being persistence across the lifespan for language disorder. So we expect that in about 7 to 10-ish% of the population. So that's actually pretty large, right? A much higher rate of children who might have an early language delay. So not be in the birth to five period, maybe not be meeting some of the milestones. But many of those children do sort of spontaneously recover. They catch up with their typical peers. What I think is that we have, we definitely have more children who need services than we typically have resources available. But I will also say that I think part of it is also just knowing about the resources that are available. So in addition to the school-based services that start at three, there are birth to three programs as well. So for children that are federally funded, it's just through a different branch of the special education legislation. And so if caregivers have concerns about communication, if they feel like their child is not able to communicate their wants and needs in the ways that they see other children their child's age doing, there are also resources for evaluation and intervention in birth to three as well. And then part of those services should be planning transition to preschool and the school-age services.
Jeff, in terms of caregivers, how do you talk with families to help them best support a child who might need these services or who feels frustrated in the classroom or is having difficulty communicating with their peers?
Well, I hope that the parents would reach out to an adult caregiver that's part of the team on our school staff. And that might be a homeroom teacher with whom they already have a relationship. It could be a principal. It could be somebody in the district office. That we all want the best for every kid. And the earlier that we can get those interventions in place, the more likely that student is going to be successful. But in the end, I want us to be seen as teammates in this incredible project of helping a child grow. And that if we do that together in partnership, if we ask the hard questions together at the same table, we're more likely to get positive results for that kid. instead of the frustrating isolation of trying to do that important work alone.
Rebecca, you mentioned the word resilience. Mm-hmm. And also addressing some of the concerns really early on in a child's life.
Yeah.
What is the catch up like in terms of the child being able to really develop some of these skills early and then being able to be at that level of their peers?
It's a great question. So the earlier we can intervene, the better. Typically we see that children's developmental trajectories related to language are the most malleable during the birth to five period. So where there's less variability, there's less change in course between kindergarten and high school graduation than there is potential in that birth to five period. That doesn't mean that services in the schools aren't helping by any means, but we know that that birth to five period is just a really productive time for language learning, which sets the foundation for literacy skills, which sets the foundation for math skills. As well, you think about math, it's taught using language. We think about all of these skills across domains. So the earlier we can support children, the better. And the amazing thing, too, is that early high-quality interactions with caregivers are really a great buffer against lots of different forms of potential early adversity. So there's a lot that we can do to support children.
Well, Rebecca and Jeff, thank you so much for joining us for the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is speech-language pathologist Rebecca Alper, an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at UW-Madison and director of the Waisman Center's Language Literacy and Learning Lab, and Jeff Wright, superintendent of Sauk Prairie School District. They joined us for a look at the increased need for speech and language intervention services in schools and how kids' screen time early in life could be a factor.
Coming up, a giant pumpkin grower in Fond du Lac County has been growing these massive orange beauties for 25 years and breaking records.
I like saying I have pumpkin friends 11 months out of the year, and then during that last month, I get very competitive.
The toil, the passion, the thousands of pounds per pumpkin, that's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Kids are carving their pumpkins this time of year, but a giant pumpkin grower in Fond du Lac County is looking ahead to next season and a new record to break.
Jim Ford of El Dorado is a member of the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers Association, and earlier this month he took home the top prize at the Stillwater Harvest Fest in Minnesota. His winning pumpkin tipped the scales at 2,491 pounds. That's roughly the weight of a giraffe.
That's still a lightweight. It's not the heaviest pumpkin Ford's grown. He set the state record last year for the biggest pumpkin in Wisconsin history at 2,551 pounds, about the weight of a small car.
To find out what it takes to grow a record-breaking pumpkin, Jim Ford joins us now from his pumpkin patch. Jim, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, describe where you are right now. I gather you're near your pumpkin patch. What does it look like?
Well, my pumpkin patch right now looks like a bunch of grass growing. I got something called winter rye, called a cover crop. So there's not much going. The last pumpkin was picked almost 2.5 weeks ago. So that the patch is rototilled. There's no pumpkin plants. I have a cover crop in, and we're just preserving the soil and keeping the soil alive until next time I put a pumpkin plant in the ground. So there's not much going on, just like a farmer's field this time of year after everything's been harvested. Kind of looks barren.
Sure. So can you reflect on the season? How many did you grow? What was the season like for you?
I grew 3 plants this year, and I had a mishap on my first one, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on that one. So, but But I took it to the Indiana State Fair in mid-August and took first place there. So I turned a disaster into a little bit of a victory, but it still had some growing. So the last two, I also took first place. In late September, I went to Eau Claire area, Altoona, and won in a way off there with a 2,469-pound pumpkin. And then my last pumpkin, about 2.5 weeks ago, I took to Stillwater, Minnesota. And I was going for my state record, but unfortunately, I didn't break my record from last year. It was only 2,491 pounds. So it was a good year, but it could have been a better year.
Only. How do you move giant pumpkins, may I ask?
We have this thing now. This would be better if this was TV instead of radio, but we have this thing called a lifting ring, and it's made out of seatbelt material. And we cinch it on the bottom, and we have a forklift we bring to the patch, and we lift it up and then quickly slide a pallet underneath it, put it down, and then the forklift takes it off to either a trailer or a truck and off to the way off.
I would imagine you're pulling a lot of weight and you have to go very carefully because aren't these giant pumpkins a little bit fragile? You don't want them to split.
Once you get past mid-August, they usually don't split after that. I've heard of pumpkin splitting en route to competitions, but it is pretty rare that it happens. Yeah. So, but you got to be concerned. You're always, a pumpkin grower is always concerned about his pumpkin for sure.
Are giant pumpkins thirsty? Do they need much water when you grow them?
Well, since at the peak of growth, they could grow anywhere between 50 to 60 pounds a day. And you do the math, water is 8 pounds a day. So, and plus the transpiration out of the leaves. Yeah, to the peak growing, if it's a hot day, I'm putting up to 150 gallons a day on each plant. So, wow. Yeah, they are thirsty, yes.
You've said that you have two uncles who brought you into the competitive world of giant pumpkin growing. When did you catch the fever?
I grew up in the inner city of Chicago, and for some goofy reason, I always enjoyed growing things from a little boy. I had an uncle who was a suburban gardener, a vegetable gardener, and he would share me plants. And then I had an uncle who was a farmer in central Illinois, and it's just in my blood. No one really had encouraged me to do it. I just did it. So I'm 68 years old. I'm still a boy playing in the dirt.
Are you still learning about how to grow these things?
Oh yeah. Yes, definitely. It's funny, you know, you think you grow a 2,400-pound pumpkin, and I could see several things that I messed up this year. And every year, yeah, you know, if you're doing the same thing, you'll get the same results. So you got to clean up your mistakes.
Is this trial and error, or do you have to tinker? Like, where do you make adjustments?
Well, you do most of your adjustments in your thinking has to be in the off season, because if you're yanking the soil and the plant during the season, you're going to confuse the soil and you're going to confuse the plant. I know that sounds crazy. So you do micromanagements during the season, but you're in the off season. That's when you start doing your macro changes, how I'm going to do things different.
And this is happening in a greenhouse off season?
No.
Okay.
I'm talking more in theory and research, talking to other growers.
Okay.
Having some hunches. No, we don't do any growing during the wintertime. Some growers like experimenting with what they call germination tests, and that means they're just addicted to growing something. So they
they pretend that they're doing research, but they're just playing in the dirt in January. So.
Jim, you mentioned you had a giant pumpkin mishap in recent months. What went on with that pumpkin, really?
You want me to go through it again? Well,
I need to relive it.
Okay. I was almost over it, and now and fortunately, it was my smallest pumpkin, so it didn't hurt that bad. And these things grow so fast, you have to adjust them on the vine as they're growing, or else the shoulders of the pumpkin will actually push against the vine and the stem, and actually they'll grow off the vine. They'll crack. So you got to reposition them during the season. And I was a little bit too aggressive repositioning the pumpkin, and I literally popped it off the vine. And yeah, so it was like 1 minute, it was 1 second it was on the vine, and the next second as we were moving it, you literally heard a pop, and it was off the vine and done growing. So we could talk about other things right now if you want to.
Well, I didn't want to find out, what did you say in that moment or how did you feel in that moment? But, we're inquiring here.
Honestly, the first thoughts is you're an idiot. And then the second thought I went, now what am I going to do with a 1,300-pound pumpkin in mid-August, So, and then within a couple hours, someone says, hey, this Saturday is the Indiana State Fair. And so I was on my way to Indiana with a 1,300-pound pumpkin. So
showing it off in a must-do situation. Jim Ford with us as we talk about the art and the skill in growing giant pumpkins. Jim is an award-winning pumpkin grower in Fond du Lac County and a member of the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers Association. Jim, what happens to these giant pumpkins after weigh-in? Where do giant pumpkins go?
Well, some people like displaying them on their front lawn. I don't think I've ever done that. 25 years of growing. Sometimes we hollow them out and put a little trolling motor. And there's events where there's pumpkin regattas on lakes and rivers. Sometimes we lift them up on a crane and 100 feet up in the air and drop it into a swimming pool or an old car and just demolish anything that's underneath it. And I have a couple pumpkins. I have one pumpkin that's going, it's on its right way to California, and it's going to be carved. And I don't know what it looks like right now. So now I'm not too sure if it's even arrived yet, but it's going to arrive sometime this week.
What? Someone just called you up and said, hey, can I take one of those giant pumpkins off your hands so we can carve it?
Simply put, yeah. Yeah. and then you negotiate a price.
Okay.
But you got to make sure you get the seeds back, because these seeds are, we hand pollinate them. So we know the genetics. They're purebred. I say they're like thoroughbred horses. We could take the lineage back generations. And so these seeds are valuable in the hands of another giant pumpkin grower. So we make sure we get our seeds back.
And from what I've heard, these seeds can be really expensive. Individual seeds for the Wisconsin state record holding pumpkin costing up to $800 a seed. Is that right?
Well, there's some caveats to that. I do not personally sell my seeds to any other giant pumpkin grower. I never have. I've never paid a penny for a seed. But there's different, that's a whole new topic that would bump us off course. So, but if you're a giant pumpkin grower and you get a hold of me, you're not going to pay a penny for one of my seeds.
Do you find that pumpkin growers around you, you're a good lot, that you help each other out?
Yeah, I think we do. We do help each other out. I like saying I have pumpkin friends 11 months out of the year, and then during that last month, I get very competitive. Yeah, I heard this line a couple of weeks ago that we compete with each other, not against each other. So we are a tight knit community, but we could be fierce competitors at the same time.
Where do you store your prized seeds? Where do you make sure that they stay in pristine condition and they're ready for you when you need them?
So who's putting you up to these questions?
I'm just a crack journalist, that's all.
Okay. So, I don't know, I'm starting to get some weird vibes here. No, we just like any seed, we store them in a cool, dry place. I put these little silica desiccant packs, so we keep them dry in a jar. Some people store them in the freezer, just so you don't take them in and out, but a freezer is a good place to store them too. So
okay, what are those GPS coordinates on that freezer? I'm just kidding. So here we go, Jim. The world record for the heaviest pumpkin, 2,819 pounds, set in England. Pair of brothers there. Do you think you have what it takes to beat that number?
A lot has to go right. I think there's a possibility that one of these years I could get there. But they're good growers. There's a lot of good growers in the world. You know, if everything goes right, who knows, maybe. But that, to be honest, that's what I'm shooting for. That's what a lot of giant pumpkin growers are shooting for. So, a measly old 2,551 Wisconsin state record isn't good enough for me. So we're pushing on.
You know, I think of you like a hobbyist who's a little bit, you know, beyond hobbying here. And I'm wondering, are young people coming up in the giant pumpkin ranks? You're 68.
Yeah, that's a good question, and we do encourage that. We do like seeing new growers every year. They push us. There's some growers that are in their young 20s. There's some competitions have youth divisions, and I would say, yes, there are some. We could have more, but we encourage that. Definitely.
Well, Jim, all the best to you and your pumpkin patch. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Jim Ford is an award-winning giant pumpkin grower in El Dorado, Wisconsin, and Jim is a member of the Wisconsin Giant Pumpkin Growers Association. He's been growing those giant pumpkins for 25 years.
Milwaukee community leaders have started an emergency citywide food drive to support families affected by the federal government shutdown, which threatens to cut off food assistance benefits for hundreds of thousands of people in Wisconsin this weekend if the shutdown isn't resolved.
The emergency food drive is through Feeding America, which is placing bins for non-perishable food items across the city in schools and libraries and other locations. And you can learn more online at feedingamericawi.org.
And we want to know, is your community organizing to help families get by during the shutdown? Are you donating to a local pantry or noticing new efforts to help other people in the neighborhood? Email us your story or tell us about the effort that's being made in your area to help.
The address is wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text to get in touch at 888-642-0232. Once again, that's 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Avery Lee Rogers, Mackenzie Crummy, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.